Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt, and alongside me, well, is no one. Jack Piatelli is not going to be on this podcast, so I just thought I'd let you know. Everything's cool, everything's fine, but we took some COVID precautions to record this episode with the Faceoff Academy's Greg Garendlian. Now, if you're not familiar with Greg, you're probably not the parent or a person that takes faceoffs. He is the utmost authority on the position, on technique, and teaching that part of the game to young players and players that are already in college, as well as developing professional level lacrosse players. Greg and I go way back. I think this is going to be a great conversation. He's one of the most engaging personalities in the sport. And without any further ado, let's just jump into it. Faceoff Academy's Greg Garendlian. We're going to learn about faceoffs today, which I think a lot of people, like, if you're a faceoff guy, you know who Greg is. If you're not, you're probably like, oh yeah, he's the guy that played in the Lizards and the Redwoods and all that stuff. But, you know, to me, he's always been the one faceoff guy who always returned my texts when I had questions about faceoffs. So I'm very thankful for that.
That's my pleasure, man.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So first off, what is the perfect kind of athlete to learn the faceoff position to you? And what's the most important characteristic they absolutely have to have?
Great question. And I get asked it a lot. It's very simple. You have to have the ability to want to be coached, because the faceoff position, when it's taught correctly, is similar to that of an Olympic lift or a golf swing. It's incredibly technical. If you get the angles down correctly, it makes it, it helps you reach your potential, but it's never ending as far as working on the tiny details, because you have an opponent. So you always adapt. You're always adapting to something new. You're always adapting to a different look. The other part of it is just a natural nervous system output. I tell people, I use this analogy. You can make, if I'm a sprint coach, you can make anybody faster, but you can't make a slow person fast, right? So if you don't have it right off the bat, you can develop it better. But there are just some people that are born with a talent that, regardless of what their technique looks like, they're going to be good because they just have it. So those are the two things that are most important. And the really, really special ones, they wanted to be coached the whole way up as they continue to have the talent.
And you're the creator, along with our mutual friend, Jerry Raganese, and others, of the Faceoff Academy. What were the early beginnings of that? And how did it go from the first year to having several events and a national showcase with over 200 players this year?
Great question. And we laugh about it because there are people that try to do what we do now, and we understand that. But when the Faceoff Academy started in 2012, it was started as a side fun passion project between Jerry Raganese, myself, and Chris Mattis. Jerry Raganese and Chris were doing other people's camps, and they were kind of sick of how unorganized and money grabbish it was. For me, I was a full-time strength coach in New York City, but a lot of my clients would leave for the Hamptons in the summer. So my financial situation would dip. So I was like, well, I hate the fact that we're all pro face-off guys, and the only thing out there that's taught is cheating. Every person who ever tried to give me advice on face-offs my entire lacrosse career always taught me a cheat move, tried to teach me cheating. And it drove me nuts, because I was like, if you have to cheat, then why do it? And I'm not talking about guessing on the whistle. I'm talking, you've seen it, you know, and it's just, it was ridiculous. So I reached out to Jerry and Chris, and I said, let's create a website, because back then, like, Lax Forums was really big. Right.
Yep.
And Jerry made a name for himself on Lax Forums as like a face-off guru.
So how we know each other.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. That's how I know him.
Yeah.
And then Jerry came to New York City, and I coached him a couple of times while he was at RIT. So we became friends. But I told him, I was like, why don't we create a face-off only version of this? Because the most popular forums on Lax Forums were always the crazy face-off guys. So I was like, let's create a hub for face-off guys. And then let's go do like a 6-city tour. Let's, instead of doing the overnight 4-day camps that everybody does, let's go do a 2.5 hour clinic where we can come in, teach the kids exactly what we know, and then leave. Teach them a system of training for face-offs. I came up with this system in 2011 when I blew my knee out. Up to that point, I was just kind of, I had never been a face-off only guy until I got to the MLL. So I was still just athleting it. When I blew my knee out, I sat on the couch and really was like, man, I haven't really taken advantage of my talent. Like I'm a strength coach. I'm a kinesiology guy. I should apply the biomechanics I know to Olympic weightlifting and strength training to face-offs. Because unlike any other position in lacrosse, it's always consistent. The ball's always in the same spot. You're always lined up the same way. So I applied it. And then in 2012, when I came back from my knee injury, I had a career year. And then in 2013, I was better. And then I just kept getting better. So I was like, there's something to it. So then I taught guys like Trevor Baptiste, Ben Williams, and all of a sudden these guys were all Americans doing really well. So, you know, that's the long story of it. So when we did the FOA, we did these little clinics, and next thing we know, our emails were just filled. Our boxes, when are you coming back? Okay, well, let's do local clinics and then let's do weekly stuff. And then all of a sudden, let's help with recruiting. And then, you know, and then eventually I had no choice. I had to sell my strength training business and I took FOA on full time because it was just so much more fun to work with kids. And then Jerry, Chris and I decided to create a business out of it. So we did localized training and Chris and Jerry and I were flying all over the country. And we had a couple of ideas. The idea was local training weekly for kids. So they have a weekly place to go and get better. And then travel for main events to places that are underserved. So we spent a lot of time in Florida, Texas, California, Minnesota. And then let's create a national event where all the kids all over the country can come and demonstrate their talent and compete against each other with the national showcase. The national showcase the first year, we had about 77 kids show up. We were begging people to come in the door, but we did a good job. The next year, 200 kids signed up. Now, every year, 250 kids sign up within about 24 to 48 hours. We have about 13 or 14 coaches now, and we only hire guys that we have coached. So it's actually an awesome staff of guys that we've known since they were in like high school. And it's a family and it's awesome. And it all started from a passion project. And we try not to lose that mentality.
Yeah, I can attest. I went to my first one earlier this month with you guys down in Jersey at the Sportica complex. And after I came back from the event, I had to explain to everyone I was working with and some mutual friends what it was. And everyone's reaction was exactly the same. Wait, it was all facing off. They didn't play games. And my response was the face off is the game within the game for them, which made me sound very Matrixy. So I enjoyed that. It was fun. Oh,
you know, it is Matrix Day. So congratulations on that.
It is. It is. We are all Neo today. I do need to follow it up with a pretty sensitive question. Why are face-off guys so weird?
It's a great question.
Please explain it to me.
It's a great question. It's actually more easy to understand than you might think.
Okay.
Let me put it in this term, okay? Put yourself in my shoes.
Right.
You have played lacrosse for, over 20 years, okay? You have competed at the highest level. You have competed in high school, college, international, pro. You've won championships. You've broken records. You have friends, coaches, everybody that you admire, that you have played for, sweated with, you know. And every single day of your life, you have to explain why you should exist, though.
That's a good point.
Nobody in the locker room understands you. No one understands what you're going through. If you're an attackman, you can get detwigged and throw the ball away 8 times. But if you have a hat trick, you're the man.
Yep.
In faceoffs, you have a box score. And if you went under 50%, you suck. If you went over 50%, you're good. And that's all people know. So Nobody understands us. That's why. So to us, you guys are all weird. You play with the front of your stick. You run up and down the field. You can throw the ball away and no one yells at you. For us, all we have is each other. That's why it's so important to have at least 2 guys on a roster so we have someone to talk to.
It's a great point. What do you think is the most comparable position to it in another sport? And I know people say football kicker, but we know who those people are and that they're wrong.
You know, it's interesting because somebody just made this analogy. Where was I? Someone just made this analogy to a baseball player. And I would say if you had a pinch hitter, because as a pinch hitter in the AL, say you bat three times in a game, or designated hitter, right? Designated hitter in the AL, you bat three or four times a game. So, and you have to come up big because they could have suited anybody else up to take those hits. And you are on the field for about 10% of the time, and 90% of it's mental because you're not even in the field, right? You're just sitting there and you're a designated hitter. But it would be as if you had completely different batting rules than everybody else. So it's interesting. You know, the kicker thing is kind of interesting too, because you're expected to make the extra points. If you miss them, everyone hates you. But it would be similar to a kicker who is also allowed to be roughed on every single time they kick. So if you're completely allowed to blast a kicker, then that would probably be the easiest analogy, because no one understands kickers. We know if they make it or lose it or miss it. We don't know anything about the hold or any of that stuff. And it's a really lonely world when you're not doing well. So probably, you know, I hate it, but it's probably a kicker, to be honest.
Yeah. Which player, not to single out a single one, but see if you can, which player have you coached in the last 10 years that's come the farthest? And have you ever coached a player from like straight up zero all the way to D1?
Oh, there's been a lot of kids that we've coached who come in for the first time right before high school or in high school, change positions. When I, my first year at Mamaroneck in 2019, there was a kid, Shane Smith. He was a crazy athlete, but he didn't have any technical ability or anything. And I showed up, he was a senior. He was already committed as like a two-way middie at Union. And I started speaking to him and telling him everything, and he listened. And he led Mamaroneck to the first ever state final appearance in history. And there's a kid right there who I was just super impressed with. Obviously, you know, we have guys like Trevor Baptiste, where if you watch his original high school videos, it's raw. He was just an athlete. But I would say the person who was probably the most impressive to me off the top of my head was Jake Withers. Jake Withers, people might not remember, but he took a couple face-offs for Ohio State when he was a freshman and sophomore, and he was neutral grip, on a knee, toe down, swiping and hacking at people. He had no clue what to do. I went out to Ohio State, spoke, Coach Kester was out there at the time, and Coach Myers. We sat down, we introduced the system to the staff. We broke down how we teach it. Coach Kesterer is a phenomenal college faceoff coach, and he has zero ego. Took a lot of the stuff we talked about. Jake immediately bought in, listened immediately, and was a two-time Big Ten all-time specialist, and was a two-time All-American. And now he is one of the top three or four faceoff guys in the world, both indoor and outdoor. So when you talk about a guy who just listened and swallowed his ego and became one of the best in the world, there he is. And he's the Team Canada faceoff guy. I mean, there's a perfect example.
This is a question I usually ask D1 coaches or D3 coaches. And I think the answer from you will be a little different. And that's, what's the biggest difference between a Division I faceoff guy and Division III faceoff guy? Because the usual answer is size. Right? Everyone knows that. But what is your answer?
Yeah. Size shouldn't matter in any way, shape, or form. That's what drives me nuts about faceoff guys. You know, yeah. Trevor Baptiste is 5'11", 230. TD is what? 5'8", 5'9", 170, 160. I don't know. I'm 6'1", 225. Anthony Kelly is like 7 foot tall, 800 pounds. Like, it shouldn't matter, because with the rule change now, speed and technique is king. I think, honestly, the only difference between Division I and Division III faceoff guys now is either some guys wanted to go to a school that, you know, maybe they wanted to go to like an ACC school. They have the grades, but they didn't have quite the talent. So maybe they go to the next guy. And then you have the other guys who have the talent, they just haven't had enough years of training. And that's what I'm running into. You went to National Showcase, there were 250 kids in that room. And that's just like the top kids. There's way more kids than there are places in college right now, as far as D1 schools. So D3 and D2 faceoff guys have never been better. Look at Connor Farrell.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're telling me Connor Farrell shouldn't have played D1? He set the all-time NCAA record for faceoff percentage. So I think that's the only difference, is I have a lot of kids who just haven't been from traditional hotbeds, who don't get the same thing. And you know it, a coach will always be like, Texas kid who went 92%, Long Island kid who went 60% or 58%. better competition, I'm going to go to the Long Island kid.
Right.
But when you traditionally look at the All-Americans, they're from everywhere, you know? So it's interesting.
Yeah, and it's really a lot of a numbers game too. Like you were saying, the rosters of these Division I teams, you know, they're not carrying six faceoff guys. Like right. No one's doing that. It's actually more like, you know, goalies where they have three or four max. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not carrying a ton of guys. So those spots are naturally limited and it increases the competition for them. But I have noticed just in covering recruiting in the past, like summer, past year, that coaches are very into having a blue chip faceoff guy in their class to like make their class that next level, right? Like that's the thing that kind of differentiates them.
I think that's a smart move. I know Coach Tamberoni and I spoke before Penn State on September 1, and his thing was like, I want to get a top five faceoff guy and I want to get a top five goalie and I want to build the class around it when I call these kids on September 1 and 2. And if you're a smart, aggressive college coach, that's what you're shooting for. So I think that's the smart move. Get a goaltender, get a faceoff guy and build your recruiting class around that.
Yeah. A lot of faceoff guys were upset when they were forced to switch their stances to standing neutral grip in the last round of NCAA rule changes. Why do you think the rules committee keeps tinkering with the faceoff rule so much?
Oh God, we don't have enough time in the day for me to explain.
No, just like, why do you think that? I mean, I have my answer, but I'm curious if it's the same as yours.
The problem is there are two versions. There's the one that is said and there's the one that's reality. What is said, the PC version that we're always told is it's for the game. It's better for the game. Got to get the ball out quicker. Got to make it closer to a 50-50% game. We can't have one guy take over the game.
Yeah.
What's the reality though? Is you have eight guys in a room who all have something to gain from what the rule change is. It's human nature. I'm not calling anybody a terrible person. I'm just saying that if you're going to tell me that Coach Desko changed his stance on faceoffs after he got Ben Williams was a coincidence, and it's the only time that's happened, I'm going to tell you you're a liar. So it's human nature. That's our problem. We have eight people who I think majority of definitely want to do something better for the game. But I always come back to, if that's true, then why wouldn't you listen? Doesn't have to be me, but listen to somebody who obviously wants to help the game. Because we can get this done in a weekend if we wanted to. And also, why doesn't the rules committee hold the officials accountable, right? If I do something, if we sit in a room all weekend and Inside Lacrosse and Greg Renly and people are yelling on Twitter and we get something done, if we really think it's right, we better go to Mr. Abbott and say, look, this is exactly how we want it done, because that never happens. Since 2015, the one-step rule has been in play. Redirect the ball immediately after one step. That hasn't been enforced once in 6 years. So what we'll do is we'll keep changing the rules every 2 years. The kids will keep suffering, but we won't get it right because there's egos involved. And I think if we all just step back and just swallowed our egos, we could hammer this out in a couple hours.
Yeah. I mean, that being said, like, you were part of a rules committee that made the rules for the first season of the PLL. What changes did you make there? And like, are those the same things you would apply to current NCAA rules?
And I give the PLL a lot of credit that first year. Trevor Baptiste led the PLL with like 58%. And the top six or seven guys in the league were all within 7 or 8%.
Yeah.
And it wasn't I wasn't going for, let's make everybody 50%. What I was going for is let's make it fair, quick, and easy. So what we did was we lined the sticks up like this, because if your problem is lockups, okay, that's one of the things people complain about, then why are you letting refs line the ball up near the throat? That's the strongest part of plastic where the hands are. Okay. So you line the ball up here, keep guys' hands off the plastic. We all can see. If you can't tell what plastic and metal is, then you shouldn't be officiating because you can't see, right? Keep them like this, balls at the top. Floppy part of the plastic. As soon as we hear the whistle and we go, whoever has a little bit more of the ball is incentivized to get it out. The other part is move the wings in 1 yard on each side. Now, if you stay in a lockup, the wings are going to get in there and bury you. So it incentivized to get guys get the ball out quicker. It didn't matter if you were knee down or stand up. Didn't matter if you were a pole or a shorty. And you had to use your wings or else you were going to get killed because you were just going to keep pulling the ball out with a wing coming in on you. So we saw more long pole faceoffs off of, you know, long pole goals off of faceoffs than we'd ever seen in lacrosse because the ball was spraying all over the place. But then we decided that we were going to just write a blank check to the officials in 2020-21. And now they're doing these mousetrap set calls and guys are going early on every single faceoff. And now you're seeing 70, 69, 80% gains all over the place. And, you know, everything that we worked on kind of went away.
New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal will return after this message. Catch the Sacred Heart University Pioneers on the ice this season. The Pioneers Division I men and women's hockey programs will not disappoint. Season ticket packages and individual tickets are on sale now at sacredheartpioneers.com. And opening in 2023, Sacred Heart University's Martiri Family Arena, a brand new 122,000 square foot premier skating facility in Fairfield, Connecticut. Learn more at sacredheartpioneers.com.
Are you serious about playing your sport in college? Do you need a flexible education that allows you to maintain your practice and competition schedules while also preparing you to succeed at the next level? You should check out the University of Nebraska High School. UNHS is accredited and offers more than 100 online courses, including NCAA-approved courses to protect your academic eligibility. Students could earn a UNHS diploma or take a single course for transfer credit. Courses are college prep, self-paced, and available 24/7, 365. Enroll anytime and take up to a year to complete a course. Visit highschool.nebraska.edu today.
Looking to keep up with all the latest news and information on New England lacrosse? New England Lacrosse Journal and LaxJournal.com are the premier resources for information and inspiration on the New England lacrosse scene. Have every issue of New England Lacrosse Journal, the magazine, delivered to your home or office. And don't forget to stay in the game every day with a digital subscription to LaxJournal.com to receive daily digital lacrosse coverage on club lacrosse, college commits, prep and high school, Division I, II, and III colleges, showcases, rankings, and much more. Get in the game and behind the scenes now by logging on to LaxJournal.com. Just click on the subscribe button and start the subscription that is right for you today. New England Lacrosse Journal is a Siemens Media publication. Siemens Media, inspiring, informative, insightful.
I asked you earlier this summer how to better evaluate faceoff guys when I'm writing about them. And one of the things you told me was to watch how they exit the draw and how they control the ball. And that was one of the most important things to look for. That comes from you. But what is it that you think college coaches are looking for from the same question?
I think they're looking for wins and losses. And yeah. I get that. And I obviously that's what we're trying to do. The problem is that when they're evaluating these kids, they're evaluating that the events that are incentivizing officials, not the call stuff. So if you and I are facing off and Coach Petromala is on the 50-yard line and we both want that Syracuse scholarship, I'm going to lean. This guy's 5 yards back. He doesn't care. Hand on the plastic. Do whatever you got to do. I'm getting paid. I'm going to crush you, even though you might be so much better than me. But now I just went 75% against you. And guess what? I'm in the driver's seat. So that's the problem for these college coaches is, you know, and I'd ask them straight up, well, what happens if you go to an event and you can tell the kid's leaning? And the answer I got from smart, competent coaches is, well, I want the kid to compete. Oh, man. You know?
Yeah. So no, it's definitely one of those things that, like, I'm from the generation that took face-offs as part of, like, you have fast hands, go take face-offs. You know, like, that's, like, the early 2000s, late 90s kind of mentality where, like, you just put, like, either your best player or your most explosive player at the X and hope for the best. And now it's, like, totally evolved into this completely new position with completely different techniques. And I feel like if you're not, like, the parent of a face-off kid, you're not a face-off kid, and you don't really study it, you have, it's so foreign to talk about, right? So how do we break that down? How do we make that easier? Like, what is your, I mean, I'm sure you have a plan for this. So I'm going to ask you, what's your plan to make that easier?
From an evaluation standpoint. Well, what we've done since 2012 is the FOA travels to any college that wants us, Division I, II, or III. If you want us to come out and work with your staff, we'll do it for free. We'll come out, we'll show you our FOA system, how we coach the face-off. We will teach you how we evaluate face-off guys. Recruiting is 50% of what we do at least now. So we have brought on a expert, Corey Balkin, who was a Division I assistant for three different schools. And was a pro face-off guy himself, FOA Advantage. His job is to create rankings, and not an individual ranking one through one, two, three, but like, here's the top 25 guys type of idea. And his job is to help colleges be able to see who the best guys are. Because if you go on the circuit, it's whispered down the lane. You know, I'll sit at Future Phenoms and I'll hear, oh, this five, these five kids. And then like, all the way down the lines. Oh, okay. Yeah. These are the top five. These are the top five. And they'll just obsess over those five kids. It doesn't matter if you're High Point, if you're Richmond, if you're Princeton, you're all looking at the same five kids. You know, meanwhile, I got five totally different names that I think are the best kids in the class. Right. So what we're trying to do is make that knowledge open. And then we have our free YouTube videos. So, you know, Kyle, basically what we're trying to do is we're just trying to educate coaches and say, one, here's a good way to coach the kids so that they can progress, so you understand the position better and you don't have to just send them in the corner during practice. And two, it'll help you as you understand the position better, you'll be able to evaluate it better, because our whole goal is for everyone to look at the face-off the way I do. I think if you're a coach and as you're learning this, the easiest thing to do is to ask yourself, is a kid completely relying on his hand speed? If he's smoking kids forward all the time, that's great, but he's not going to do that in college. No one does.
Right.
So when you get to college, do you have a backup idea? And there's so many events now where college coach, that's why at the National Showcase, we have college coaches come and train the kids. Cause I want a Coach Kesterer to sit there and say, okay, well, what happens if you don't get that? What would your move be? Right. The fastest hands usually have the worst counters because they never have to use them in high school. Then they get to college and they get buried because they don't know what to do when they're going 50%. So My answer would always be, find out if a kid has a counter move, if he can counter. Because if he can't counter, he's not going to last in Division I. He'll be a guy who you only use against crappy teams, and then he has to ride the bench for other guys because he's going to go up and down. And I think we can agree, every college coach would say, I want a 55% guy every game over a guy who goes 70, 30, 80, 20.
Right. Yeah. And like you said, coaches are really just looking at box scores, but one of the opportunities of seeing all those face-off guys in one spot, right? I'm following mostly New England guys just because that's what I'm writing about at the moment. And the guy who won the 2023, Gavin Umbraca, he is a counter guy.
Yep.
Like his ability to get the, like to stuff the first move of the other guy was the thing that won him that age division. And I only know that because I watched him throughout most of his group, and then into the semis and the finals. And it was tight. He was winning like 3-2 in those matchups, you know, like it was him adjusting.
Yep.
And I tried to like write about that when I wrote about him. And then I talked to his coach, and his coach is just like, oh yeah, he's really good. You know, like, yeah. And I'm like, well, like, this is why he's good though. And he's like, yeah, sure.
I don't care, man. Yeah. We get the ball 70% of the time. That's all I care about. But yeah, I think
it's true.
That's my job. My job is to articulate that. So usually what happens around recruiting time is Gavin's coach gets a call, then I'll get a call, tell me about his skill set, and then I can articulate that.
Right.
Just like you would have a head coach and you would have a wide receiver coach calling about. So I think for me, you know, Gavin is, when I look at Gavin, you're talking prototypical athletic size, a guy who can play not just face-offs. And I think when you look at what's important now, you had said this, you're not going to have six face-off guys on your roster. That's a waste of scholarship money. However, if I'm a college coach and I'm smart, I'm looking for that hand speed technical guy. And if I can get, for instance, a Jake Spallina, right? So Syracuse was able to get Johnny Mullen, who I think is the highest rated face-off guy in the class.
Norwell's own.
And then you get a Jake Spallina, who's definitely a top 10 to 15 guy, but Jake Spallina can roll in right now and be on your rides and clears. He can play man down.
Play the wings, play D-mid.
100%. Yeah. So, you know, just like look at Brian Smith at Duke. Brian Smith was an all-tournament team faceoff guy. Then he became a wing player and an offensive mid for them. Same kind of a concept. If you can get that guy, yeah, you could technically have up to like 8 faceoff guys on your roster, because you have guys who can counter and have the ability to play D-mid. That's how you really boost your recruiting, is demonstrate that you have the athleticism to do that.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, like you brought up Mullen. Mullen plays for Norwell, which is, you know, Division III public school in Massachusetts, right? Wouldn't get a ton of the attention. You wouldn't think like a kid from D3 in Mass or any other place where you're in like kind of the lower division of your state will go play at Syracuse. Yeah. But because he's, you know, he is an excellent athlete. Like I've seen tape of him as well in the championship game, and he is like a difference maker. And he's like just built. He's almost built perfectly to be like a D1.
He's built like Fowler. He's built like Brendan Fowler.
Yes. Yes.
And
who is my comp for the only normal face?
And if his marker, if that's the marker of normal for you, then we know we are completely nuts. But when Johnny Mullen, you have no idea. For the month leading up to September 1, how many college coaches had never heard of him, right?
That was my point.
I had exactly. The whole Big Ten, the whole ACC. I'm calling all these coaches on behalf of our I-95 Cup guys. And guys who don't know who I-95 Cup is, I-95 Cup is 8 states up the northeast, down the north coast, each have a face-off team. And we run like a wrestling-style team-based tournament. New York versus New England, New Jersey. And he was flat out the best guy on New England. Skill, the technique wise. And when we are talking to these college coaches, they're like, you know, who are your top 5? Here's who I have. I'm like, stop. Johnny Mullen needs to be 1 or 2 on that list. And who's Johnny Mullen? Dude,
yeah.
You know, and like, that's what I did for a month. And you're right. A lot of times. And that's where I think for face-off guys, the great equalizer is the face-off training, because he didn't, you know, if I played lacrosse right now, I wouldn't have my family, I wouldn't have been able to afford to play lacrosse. Everything's $1,000. Everything is a trip to Florida now. Everything is, you know, it's crazy. So like, you know, you have kids, you know, like Johnny, who he plays for his high school. He plays for Kings. Kings does a good job of promoting, but he's not technically on the national stage because he doesn't play for a Sweet Lax or a Primetime or 91. So my job is to make damn sure that college coaches know what kind of talent they got.
You are one of the most decorated face-off athletes in the history of pro lacrosse. But the first time I ever interviewed you was right after you got DNR'd, did not report by the MLL Chicago Machine franchise. And I think back on that conversation a lot, because you were one of the first players that really like trusted me as a reporter not to like blow anything up. And like, I remember the moment that you answered, I didn't think you'd answer the phone. And then you answered the phone and I was like, in my backyard, walking around in bare feet. And we had like a really candid, open, honest conversation. And I don't like have a question. I just wanted to tell that story. And I wanted to thank you for that, because that gave me more confidence than anyone has ever known. I've never told that story before. That is the first conversation I had with a pro guy where there was no BS. It was you and me on the phone talking honestly. And yeah, it was off the record, but you know, I wanted to ask you just like why you thought you got DNR'd, and you had great answers. And then you were like, hey, you want to talk about this? I was like, absolutely. Let's do it. And we talked for like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the thing that people maybe take for granted in lacrosse, right? It is the accessibility of the players and the coaches and the staff of all these places is like pretty there compared to other sports. Yeah. Like it's very accessible, but approaching someone on a human level, mm-hmm. having like a connection with them, talking to them like a person is really like what the game it like brings. Like that gives you that. So yeah, I wanted to tell that story and kind of get your reaction to that.
Yeah, I remember that too. And the reason it was easy for me to be candid is because I didn't look at myself as a lacrosse player. I was a full-time strength coach and I played lacrosse on the weekends. And I didn't realize what I had. I didn't value it enough until I blew my knee out, which is strange, because people who know me know that I really, like I value everything that I have. So I think I was so engulfed in my career as a strength coach that I didn't take enough care of the fact that I had this talent that I didn't do enough with. And when you called me, that was the first time where I was like, these guys are mad that I just started my own strength training business. I'm eating out of a peanut butter jar here in New York City in an apartment this big, trying to make it with no money in my name. And these guys are pissed that I can't fly to Chicago. So, you know, and I had talked to Boston about coming out there, backing up Eck or whatever, Long Island, backing up Blahakis, doing whatever. I still wanted to play, but I just couldn't fly to Chicago. And they said, okay, yeah, we're going to see what we can do. And that's when Chicago hadn't won a game in like 2 years.
Yeah.
For them, it was like, oh, this guy he's big timing us. I wasn't big enough to big time anybody. So then they put me on the shelf. And then I hear Denver was like, yeah, we're trying to get you, but I don't know what you did, but they're pissed.
Yeah.
I think I remember Reese calling me. He's like, I don't know what you did, but they're not going to talk to anybody about you. So I lost a year of my career because people were salty. What rubbed me the wrong way is I really loved playing for the Dragons. I really loved playing for Doug Locker and that whole group. So when that collapsed, a part of me really was upset because I had finally found a place in the MLL where I was valued. But I always say, thank God I had that really good game against the Lizards when I played for the Dragons, or else I don't know if Jim Ulay and Spolino would have ever taken a chance. But I really, you know, you called me and you were interested in talking about it. And that was like, you know, I always say, I said this to every young guy who came into the league while I was there. One day, no one's going to ask for your autograph. One day, no one's going to call you to see what your status is, to see if you're playing this year. Everyone's going to stop calling. And are you going to sit back and regret being a jerk and storming off the field that one time? Are you going to be, you know, upset that you didn't pick up the phone when a Kyle Devitt calls and actually is interested in you? And I know that, you know, after my career, I have no regrets because I did that stuff because people cared. And if you are going to spend money to come watch me play lacrosse, then I better, one, show up on field, but two, I better take some time afterwards to show you that I appreciate it.
Yeah. When the MLL folded, were you like, not upset, but like, what was your feeling when that happened? Cause I think like your career is like a lot of MLL and like helping to create a lot of things in PLL, but you know, not, you know, it was short-lived just because, I mean, the league's only been around for 3 years. Everyone's career is short-lived, but you know what I'm saying.
You know, I'm a big Ray Lewis guy and Ray Lewis always talked about legacy. And he was like, you know, records, championships, you know, that stuff's great, but he's like, what did you do while you're on the field that affected people? And how did you leave the game when you were done? That's your legacy. And I was like, man, like when the ML is gone, are they going to erase the record books? Like, am I going to not exist anymore? Are you going to tell me that for 14 years I did nothing? And I'm glad they didn't. I thought when they announced that the new franchise was going to be the Cannons and that they absorbed the old, they were going to create a Hall of Fame. They were going to absorb the old players. They were going to talk about their statistics, their careers. I was elated because I was like, good. Like, at least I feel like, you know, it wasn't all for nothing.
Right.
You know, I'm devastated enough that my second son's never going to get to watch me play lacrosse, right? So, but I was sad because the MLL, I owed so much to the MLL. I was more upset that they didn't get it right so that we didn't have to have a PLL than I was that, you know, the MLL fold.
Same. Because, you know, I mean, and I don't know if everyone listening to this understands this, but like that was where MLL was where like I'm probably the only person that made a career out of it besides maybe like Joe Keegan, who now works for the MLL. Like it was, you know, like you said, eating out of a peanut butter jar. It was, I have to disguise this is such a bad story, but you'll appreciate it. So okay. I went into a Whole Foods store. And I would go in and they had a pancake mix and it was really cheap. And then they had like protein powder and it was not cheap. And I would get the protein powder and mark it as the pancake mix and bring it up. Cause I need it. Like I was like, you know, I was working out. I'm a fit person. I needed it. And I was like, I feel bad about this, but one day I'm not going to have to do this.
It's all good.
One day, if I stick with this, I'm not. And now I don't.
And now you go to the supermarket and you leave an extra five there.
Yeah. I don't worry about what I'm buying anymore. It's very wonderful. And I like the thing that people don't understand is like when you get to a position where you can make a living doing what you love to do, you like don't think about money as much as you did when you were like, oh my God, what am I going to eat?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, how am I going to get through this?
Stressful. And look, you know, we're in the lacrosse world. I feel like this is where not only am I a face-off guy, but I'm an outsider in lacrosse in general. I've always felt that way.
Yeah.
You know, I went to a public school. I chose my college because of my family and who I grew up watching football over lacrosse. I went and became a strength coach. I didn't work finance. You know, I didn't have like a whole group of, you know, college alumni to hug in these MLL and PLL huddles.
Yeah.
I did it my own way and I didn't have any financial help. And, you know, that's not something to brag about. It's something to just say, look, man, like none of this was easy for me and I value all of it. So when I'm training kids, I really have a soft spot for the kids who come from a similar situation. Because I feel like if we're ever going to make lacrosse grow the sport, we're not going to grow the sport by making everything $1,000. Now, look, yes, it's a business and you should charge certain amounts for the effort you put into certain things. But we should all be doing things that don't cost a lot of money as well so that we can invite more people into this sport that aren't from the wealthiest, you know, groups in the areas of the country, because, you know, it's a beautiful game and we should be sharing it with everybody.
Yeah. And I think that's like an amazing point to leave on it. And if you're listening to this and you're a player or you're a parent and you know, you don't have to worry about that. It's the holiday season, man. Give a little thanks, maybe try and give a little back to someone that might have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Because that's a real thing. I mean, I'm from the smallest town in New Hampshire, man. And I get to write about lacrosse at what I consider the highest level. I'm very lucky, but it was not just luck. It was a lot of hard work and it was a lot of support from other people. And, you know, every time I get a chance to thank someone, I do that. So yeah. I think that's kind of something that it's a good holiday message to leave on. And, you know, I know you agree with that. And, you know, I'm thankful for our relationship and everything we get to do together. And thank you for educating me about face-offs, man. I used to, like I said, when we started, I used to be like, the coach would be like, Devitt, take a face-off. And you're like, oh God, really? Even now I play men's league and they're like, you took face-offs, right? And I'm like, no, no, I didn't. And they're like, just go. And I'm like, oh, this guy's going to murder me. And then he does. Yeah. And everyone gets mad. That's exactly to your point. You know what I mean? Like everyone gets mad at you when you lose a face-off.
The end of the bench you go.
Hey man, you told me to go do it. And then I lost it. So it's your fault.
But you know what? Like while we're here, I just want to say thank you because, you know, professional lacrosse was not easy, has never been easy. You get resistance from players. You get resistance from the people that run the leagues a lot of times. And you continued to do it and people listen. And I'm really glad that there's people like you out there in our sport, because if not, not nearly enough people would care.
Yeah. But well, appreciate that. And again, great note to leave on. Thanks again. Happy holidays to you and your family and everybody at FOA. Give Jerry's beard a tug for me and we'll talk soon.
All right, brother. Happy holidays. Happy New Year, man. Take care.
Thanks a lot. See ya. And that was Greg Garenlian. Usually I have Jack here to bounce off what he thought, but it's just me. And I got to tell you, man, if you care at all about face-offs, you have to follow this man. You got to follow his business. You have to, he'll have a conversation with anybody. And I'm really thankful for that. And there's a lot of personal stuff at the end of that interview. And you know, I think it is important to acknowledge people that have helped you along the way. And Greg really helped me. He answers every text I send him. I can be annoying with stuff like that. And he's so gracious with his time. Gracious here. He almost missed a chiropractic appointment just to stay on the line and finish the podcast with us. So really thankful for him coming on and hope you enjoyed that. Just want to wish you happy holidays. Jack will be back next week. And just want to say again, thanks for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piatelli, who is not here, I'm Kyle Devitt, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Also, listen to the podcast on the website, laxjournal.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @NELaxJournal, Instagram at New England Lacrosse Journal, Lax Journal on Facebook, and our email address, chasingthegoal@laxjournal.com. Join us again next time as we go chasing the goal. Chasing the Goal, a Siemens Media podcast.